Welcome. Please enter your passcode followed by the pound sign. There are 14 other callers on the call. At any time, press 4 for conference instructions. Please announce yourself.
Try and answer as many questions as time allows.
While in a conference, to exit, press 3. For this help message, press 4. To mute or unmute your phone, press 6.
Here.
And Peter.
This line is now unmuted.
Jonas.
This line is now muted.
Gregory, can you repeat that? Can you confirm that you're not muted, Peter?
I can confirm I'm not muted.
And Ray, once again, just to make sure.
Well, I'm here. You tell me if
okay.
I'm muted.
We can hear you loud and clear.
Then it's confirmed.
Okay.
I want to be precise like a software designer.
So if anyone's just joined, participants are muted from this point forward. The call is also being recorded from this point forward and will begin in just a few more moments.
We're actually still hearing beeping. I don't know if that's participants joining or what.
I think that the beeping you're hearing is I'm performing some operations related to the administration call. So for those just joining, this call is being recorded. This is Gregory with Defective by Design. And if you have questions during the presentation for Ray Beckerman or Peter Brown, you can email them to question@defectivebydesign.org or through the website at defectivebydesign.org. Click on Contact and choose the Ask a Question, conference call question option. And we'll begin in just a few more moments. Okay, I want to thank everyone for joining us this afternoon. This is Gregory Heller with DefectiveByDesign.org, and we have a program today that includes Ray Beckerman, who's a lawyer working on some RIAA cases, and Peter Brown, who is the executive director of the Free Software Foundation, which is the parent organization of Defective by Design. I'm going to turn it over to Peter in a minute. I just want to get a little bit of housekeeping out of the way right now. Folks who are on call are muted, and we will be opening it up to questions at the end of the call, but we do ask that you submit your questions via email so that we can then call on you so that it doesn't become a a nightmare of people trying to get their questions in. You can submit questions to question@defectivebydesign.org, and then we'll call on you, and when we do, you can unmute by pressing 6, ask your question. This call is being recorded and will be made available on the Internet via our website later on today, so you can point your friends to it. And again, the web address, of course, is defectivebydesign.org. So without further ado, I turn it over to Peter Brown, the Executive Director of the Free Software Foundation. Peter?
Thanks, Gregory, and welcome, everybody. On June 23rd, the Defective by Design campaign organized a phone-in targeting the executives at the Recording Industry Association of America, the RIAA, and similar trade organizations in Europe and Canada. We did this to allow our supporters to express their frustration with the big media's attempt to force DRM into our technology and onto our society. Through the action, we became aware of the work of Ray Beckerman and his excellent blog, Recording Industry Against the People, or Versus the People. Ray practices law in New York State and is the lead attorney there in the fight against the RIAA lawsuits. From speaking with Ray, I came to realize, and the campaign came to realize, that we are in fact fighting the same battle, but just on two separate fronts. That battle is the battle of consumer control. DRM is simply an attempt to win this battle with technology restrictions, and the other is an attempt to win the battle through intimidating lawsuits that they also hope will allow them to rewrite copyright law. It's very important that we understand what's going on in these lawsuits and realize that, in fact, there is no real support going on. The RIA is really being allowed to run mock here, and we need to take some action. So let me introduce to you Ray Beckerman, and let's find out what's happening with these lawsuits, how it's connected to DRM, and what we can do to help. Ray, why don't you fill us in on what's going on?
Well, for almost 3 years, the RIAA has been conducting a reign of terror, and they have actually tripped across what is possibly their most effective device, which is bringing lawsuits against defenseless people. You have multi-billion dollar cartel suing unemployed people, disabled people, housewives, single mothers, home health care aides, and all kinds of people who have no resources whatsoever to withstand these litigations. And due to the adversary system of justice, the RIAA will be successful in rewriting copyright law if the world at large and the technological community in particular doesn't fight back and help these people fighting these fights. Every time you learn of one of those rare instances in the 19,000 litigations in which one person has fought back, it means that there's a lawyer out there who's either working for free or getting a nominal fee for his work. And you'll notice that you will never see a big law firm in that category. For one thing, the big law firms are like any big corporation. They need to make a profit, and that's what their primary purpose is. And they would be interested in representing the RIAA, not the poor people that the RIAA are suing. Now, these cases raise very important legal issues and relating to privacy and not just music, but technology. The way this campaign begins is with an investigation that is not an investigation at all. The sophisticated audience to which I'm speaking will realize how bogus it actually is. They have an investigator pretend to be a user of Kazaa or one of the other similar file sharing networks. He finds a shared files folder that has a goodly number of copyrighted songs in it. He has no idea whether those song files were obtained legally, whether through paid downloads or through making personal copies from one's own CD for backup purposes, or whether anything illegal was ever done with those files, whether anyone ever copied one. And what he does, he takes a screenshot of those of this shared files folder, in which he, of course, does not see the folders. He merely sees the text in the metadata and decides that this is a big shared files folder. Then through some secret process, which he will not share with us and has tried to conceal from the courts, he then associates it with a dynamic IP address. And then, after he has what he believes is the correct dynamic IP address for the date and time at which he made that screenshot, he then brings a proceeding to get the name and address of the subscriber who paid for the internet access, which of course would tell us nothing. But once he gets that information, he then sues the person. The way he gets the information is a one-sided lawsuit against the host of John Doe's. Usually the people who are named as defendants in those cases live in cities hundreds or thousands of miles away from where the lawsuit is pending. They only find out about it after an order has already been entered directing the turnover of the information. They usually receive just a few days' notice, and they're told that unless they can hire a lawyer in that far-off city and that lawyer can make a motion to quash the subpoena and vacate the order, that therefore the information will be turned over. And of course, at that point, they don't even know that there's a lawsuit. Most of them do not even know that they have been sued. They do not have copies of the court papers. They don't have copies of the application for the order. They have absolutely no way to resist. Now, a couple of people have been alert enough to alert the Electronic Frontier Foundation and others, and so we've managed to bring a few cases in which we've attacked this initial John Doe process. But the judges, who are anything but digital natives, have no understanding of it, have given us very short shrift, haven't listened to anything that we've had to say. There was a case in 2004 where an elderly judge was told by a lawyer in his brief from the RIA that from the metadata and the hash, you could tell that these were illegally copied files, which was, of course, nonsense. But the judge actually referred to that in his decision as to why he was upholding the subpoena. Once they get the name and address of the victim, they then basically seek to extort a settlement of either $3,750 or $4,250. If the victim calls them up and tells them that they've never even done any file sharing of any kind, they have no idea what it's about, they're completely innocent, the RIA doesn't care, and then it commences a federal lawsuit. Now, defending a federal lawsuit is an extremely costly process. If you get into the merits of the case to prove that you're innocent, you've already lost, because under any scenario, you're talking tens of thousands of dollars at least in legal expenses in order to defend such a case. Now, there are some very important cases going on. In my office, we've tried to attack this process early on. We're the only firm that lately has made motions to vacate the John Doe cases. Once the name and address is known and they sue a person in their name, they still have this extremely vague complaint which tells you nothing because they know nothing. They say that the defendant downloaded, distributed, and/or made available for distribution certain song files. But they have no evidence of any downloading. They have no evidence of any distributing. And at most, they can say that someone who might somehow be associated with that IP address might have made some files available. But they certainly don't know that the defendant did. All they know the defendant did was to write out a check to the internet access. Now, you know, we've tried to point out in our John Doe cases that the technical underpinning of the investigation is meaningless, that the metadata doesn't tell you anything, that it can be scrubbed, that it can be changed, that any real pirate would never leave the metadata of the thing he had purloined, and the IP address makes no sense because any real pirate would be using someone else's internet access account. The metadata tells you nothing. The hash marks do not conclusively establish anything. Even seeing the shared files folder doesn't tell you which computer it resided on, because all of these networks use one form or another of a hierarchy of computers, those with fast broadband connections and those with dial-up and slow broadband connections. So you have the nodes and super nodes or whatever terminology they use. So that when you see the shared files folder, you're seeing metadata from one computer or from a group of computers that are connected to one node. But the judges have no clue. They actually won't even let me talk about it. One of the three motions had no oral argument, and the two that had oral arguments, the judges would not let me speak and kept cutting me off. Now, there's a case called Electra versus Barker, which has become very important. This is a nursing student who was sued in her name. We made a motion to dismiss the complaint because it doesn't specify any acts, dates, or times of copyright infringement as the law normally requires. And what's happened here, we've made several arguments like that before this motion, and the RIA put in an argument which basically fudged it. However, in this case, they decided to go for the gold, and they made a very bold argument, claiming that merely making files available on the internet is in and of itself a copyright infringement. It was a shocking argument because if it were accepted, it would probably shut down the entire internet. As a result of that bold argument, certain organizations came in putting in amicus curiae brief to support Ms. Barker's motion to dismiss. In reaction to that, the Motion Picture Association and the United States government put in briefs supporting the RIAA, the Motion Picture Association directly supported that extreme argument. The U.S. government didn't quite go that far, but it tried to help support the RIAA by attacking another argument that had been made by the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Meanwhile, Ms. Barker is a nursing student. She has no money. She lives in the housing project. And she has to have lawyers reviewing all these briefs, writing briefs for her, et cetera. Now, this case is pending, and the judge may call for oral argument, or he may render a decision. But if our motion to dismiss is granted and sustained on appeal, it would mean the end of the RIA juggernaut against innocent people not known to have committed a copyright infringement. And yet we've received no support of any kind from anywhere. And Ms. Barker has no resources to defend this case. There's another case, UMG versus Lindor, where the defendant, Marie Lindor, is a home health aide who's never even used a computer. She's never owned a computer. She's never even turned on a computer. The only connection she has ever had to a computer is that she has on occasion dusted near the parts which she believes are a computer. And yet she is being sued as an online distributor in peer-to-peer file sharing. And this is a case started by her, so we were not able to, when we stepped in the middle, so we're not able to attack the complaint in the case, but we're seeking information on the cartel-like behavior of the RIA, and we're in all kinds of discovery disputes. The RIA is trying to conceal the information about how it conducts its quote investigation unquote, and is trying to conceal the information on how the different companies work together to run this campaign to destroy competition in digital music. And there's all these discovery disputes. There have been depositions. Now they're calling for depositions of the rest of her. They already deposed her and her son. They now want to depose various other relatives and her daughter. And meanwhile, they have stonewalled every discovery request we've made. And unless the world comes together and helps these defenseless people, the RIA is going to win all these battles one way or another, and they're going to rewrite the copyright law.
Well, thank you, Ray. And can I say thank you from a personal perspective for your good work and your courageous efforts here in standing with these defendants. We are here really for two reasons today on this conference call. One is to raise awareness about these lawsuits, and we'll be taking this audio and distributing it as widely as we can and encouraging people, and including the people on this call today, to please blog about this call, to please follow up with reports about the state of play of these lawsuits, and hopefully get this realization that there is no support currently underway for these efforts. And the danger there is that the RIA and the big media companies are getting to rewrite the law surrounding copyrights. And this sets a very dangerous precedent for what's going to happen with DRM. When they have control over your computer, which is their plan with DRM, what they will decide warrants a lawsuit. They will decide, and we will all be in a very difficult position. And specifically, we want to make sure that these two important cases don't get dropped because for the sake of a small amount of money. So the other reason we're here today is to help raise a small amount of money. In both this Electric versus Barker and UMG versus Lindor, we want to raise a small amount of money for the defendants involved and help send a message to them that there is some support. Now, there are 200 people on this call today, and if each of us gave $20, we'd raise the $4,000 that Ray has outlined for us could make the difference for these individuals. So I'd like to ask everyone, after they leave the call today, or right now, in fact, to go to Defective by Design and follow the links there to donate $20 minimum, and that money will be passed through to these individuals to help ensure that they stay involved in these cases. So again, Ray, thank you very much for your excellent work here.
And thank you for the excellent work of defectivebydesign.org.
Thanks. Now, before we jump to questions, I just want to reiterate again the close connection between these RIA lawsuits and the imposition of DRM. We face the same group. We face the same enemy, and it's their intention to keep us as consumers, to keep us locked in so we have no choice. They're very frightened of us turning into customers because customers have choices, and if customers have choices, they're much more likely to choose what's good for them. Now, what we obviously want to do is to allow the new business models that are out there, the new artists, to have an alternative and to allow us as individuals to have alternatives, to allow us to keep our technology free from DRM. We see the battle against the RIA. We've come to see the battle against the RIA as being a very important front for us to win on. And from speaking with Ray, it seems to me that we're at a tipping point on these lawsuits. We've had some success recently. A mother recently was allowed to now claim for her attorneys, claim expenses, claim costs against the RIAA. That could send a very important message if that comes through. And with these lawsuits here that Ray's talking about, we have a real opportunity to change the economics for other attorneys to come in and start defending people. If we can also put together a fund that will encourage attorneys to take on these cases, knowing that there is some amount of money should they reach a certain stage in their case, it will also encourage them to participate. So again, I would like to ask everyone to please consider making that donation today. Now, do we actually have any questions, Gregory?
Yes, we have a question from Jonas Jacobson. Jonas, if you press 6, you can unmute and ask your question. Jonas, are you still on the line? Hang on one second.
This line is now unmuted. This line is now muted.
Jonas, if you're on the line, please try again by pressing 6.
Okay, obviously...
I have another question from someone at UMass, LG Kent at UMass. If you press 6, you should be able to unmute and ask a question. If this doesn't work, then I'll ask them in your stead.
Hello, this is Lisa Kent at UMass Student Legal Services Office. I have spoken before. We are a student legal services office. We've represented about 52 students who have been sued for alleged downloading. As Ray was explaining, most of them end up settling because of the huge exposure. But we're preparing to go forward and defend at least one case, possibly more. And I had a question for Ray, because I'm very in a fortunate position because I have wonderful law students and undergrads who are researching some issues with me. And one of them has gone so far as to posit whether or not the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, may provide a defense that hasn't been used before. And I have to say at this point, the law clerk who's not with me is more knowledgeable than I am on this. But he's saying that as far as he can read, the individual users who are being accused of distributing files, even when the RIA can't prove that there's been any distribution, that they argue that they may have defenses under the DMCA as an ISP. And I wanted Ray to comment. I know this is a fairly technical question. I wanted to ask him whether he might have considered this or has anybody considered this possible issue.
I've considered it and rejected it because people that come to me are not ISPs. Not distributors. They're not pirates. They're not people who are in business in any way. They're not people who are providing Internet access to anybody. And Lisa, I appreciate the great work that you're doing. I'm very excited to hear of people at UMass researching these questions. And I will tell you, there's no shortage of defenses. The shortage is of people having the courage to fight and of lawyers willing to sacrifice to take these cases on.
Well, I have to again thank you for publishing or bringing to our attention all the wonderful pleadings in these cases, because we've gotten a tremendous leg up by getting any number of counterclaims and defenses that we're going to be using in our cases. The DMCA was one that wasn't listed. I think it was pretty far-fetched, but I wanted to run it by you because, again, anything that can help these poor people who have been sued, I think it's worth trying.
Thank you for your question. I'm going to ask Jonas' question unless Jonas can unmute, because I think it's a pretty important one.
While in conference, to exit, press 3. For this help message, press 4. To mute or unmute your phone, press 6. This line is now unmuted.
Okay, Jonas asked.
Hi, this is Jonas here.
Okay, you can ask it yourself.
Okay, great. My question was about service of process and personal jurisdiction. One of the things that you said, sir, was that the people who are being sued in venues far away under federal law, and I'm confused how the RIAA swings that. You know, don't we have certain rights in this country?
It's entirely illegal, but rights do not exist in a vacuum. They require lawyers to fight for them. It is completely illegal. And as I am sure you are aware, if I have a dynamic IP address, if I know the dynamic IP address of the person I'm going after, almost any teenager in the United States knows how to find out on the web what address, what state that's in, and what region of the state that's in. And therefore, the RIA either knows or has constructive knowledge that these people do not live in the state in which they're suing them as John Doe's. And I think it's their preference. They make no effort to sue these people as John Doe's where they live, because they don't want anyone to meddle or interfere. Let me ask you this. They when they seek the ex parte information, when they go to court to find out the name and address of the subscriber, why don't they send a copy of that application to the ISP so the ISP can give it to the subscribers, so the subscribers can defend and say this discovery is not warranted? They don't do that. They get the order first without any interference from anybody. Now, because they don't want interference, they don't want these people to show up. And then after they get the name and address, then they go, they discontinue the lawsuit, nothing ever gets adjudicated because under the federal rules, nothing's appealable unless it's a final judgment. And those cases are never seen through to final judgment. And then they go sue the person in the state in which that person lives. But they purposefully are bringing those cases where they know the people do not live so that they will get no interference of any kind. And in the Canada and the Netherlands, the courts look at these ex parte applications and have rejected them and said this is a bogus investigation. We will not give out information based on a bogus investigation. In the Netherlands, the courts went so far as to say not only is it bogus, it's an illegal investigation. That's a violation of people's privacy. In the United States, the judges have been rubber stamping these orders.
Thank you very much. You actually answered my second question, which was how such a minimal amount of evidence can constitute a basis for that motion. Or I guess my second question was how
the answer to that question is such a minimal basis of evidence does not provide a basis for a lawsuit.
Thank you for your time and for your good work. I'm going to go back on mute here.
Thank you.
This line is now muted.
There's a question from Bruce Byfield of NewsForge. Bruce, if you press 6, you should be able to unmute and ask your question.
Yes, my question was about, I think you actually brought some of it up already, but I wonder if you talked a little bit more about the cases outside the United States.
Well, outside the United States, these are the developments that I know of, which are quite limited. There are no cases going on in the Netherlands and Canada because the courts have not allowed them to have the information as to the name and address of the subscribers. So in those two countries, the operation has been shut down. They have to go back to the drawing board and conduct the proper investigation and only be suing people who really infringe copyrights, which means that they have nothing, so they have to start all over again. In France, the legal procedure that was followed was that they brought a sort of criminal case rather than a civil case. And there are lawyers in France traveling, and they always bring the cases in the rural areas instead of Paris. My understanding is they prefer that because they're hoping to find that there are no lawyers who know copyright law. And those cases are being litigated just like the cases here are being litigated. There seems to be a little bit more will to fight back and a little more help from the legal profession than in the United States.
Are there any signs of the RIAA going through some of the equivalent organizations in other countries?
Yes, they have sister organizations. It's never the RIAA. It's got some other acronym.
Okay.
But it's like the RIAA equivalent in that country.
Okay.
And, I know there are cases going on in other countries, but I'm just not knowledgeable as to what's going on with them.
So it is actually a worldwide phenomenon that's going on?
Excuse me?
So it is happening around the world, really.
Yes, it is, but it depends on how receptive the courts are to allowing them to get away with this chicanery.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for your question, Bruce, and I think you might have squeezed the last one in there because we are nearing the end of the half hour, and we don't want to take up too much more of Ray's time as we want him to be out there fighting the RIAA. I want to thank everyone who was on the call today for joining us and to let you know again that This call was recorded, and the audio will be made available on our website later today. That's defectivebydesign.org. And please blog about it, tell your friends about it, and stop by the website. Be sure to sign our petition to Bono, which you can link off from the front page. And also, we ask that you do make a donation via the link on our front page in the upper right-hand corner to support Ray's work in defending some of these cases against the RIAA. So thank you once again, everyone. Thank you, Ray and Peter. And stay tuned for more information from Defective by Design about what's next in our campaign.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.